We're in Luke. Last week we spent the time with a brief introduction to the book of Luke, including an outline. How do we know that Luke wrote Luke? This is not a trick question. How do we know that Luke wrote Luke? It's a two-part answer.
Well, when they're on their missionary journeys.
Who?
Luke travels with Paul. And sometimes he says we, and sometimes he says they.
Now see, there's the answer right there. Whoever wrote the book of Acts also wrote the book of Luke. We know that because they were both written to and addressed to. Pardon?
Theophilus.
Theophilus means friend of or lover of God. Theo is God and Philus is friend, friendship, affection. They're both written to Theophilus, but as Linda was pointing out, we know that the author of the book of Acts sometimes was with Paul on his journey and sometimes stayed behind. The we, they comments in the narrative. Puts the author with Paul or stopping at a city when Paul went on forward and then joining Paul again later. And then you go to Colossians 4 and you can see that Luke, I'm confused here, it's not Colossians 4. Colossians 4 tells us that Luke was a physician. But all of Paul's traveling companions except one can be eliminated of having been with him at the right time. And the one that can't be eliminated is Luke. And so Luke wrote Acts, but whoever wrote Acts also wrote the volume one. Acts is like volume two of this treatise. As you saw in Acts 1, the former treatise I wrote to you of all that Jesus began to both do and teach, Theophilus, and here in Luke 1, it's addressed to most excellent Theophilus. We'll talk about that in a minute, but that's how we know that Luke was, or are sure that Luke was the author. Now there's some confirming facts. We know from Colossians 4 that Luke was a physician, and you read in his two writings, Luke and Acts, that there are terms there that a physician would be familiar with. Doesn't prove it, but it helps support the affirmation that Luke wrote the book of Acts and therefore also the book of Luke. And there are other things, the scholarly nature of, I have translated for my own personal reference almost every book of the New Testament, and I can verify that the writings of Luke are among the most difficult because his grammar and his syntax are very, how should we say, scholarly. I've translated the Gospel of John and it's a piece of cake compared to the Gospel of Luke because John was a fisherman, had simple language, simple terms. Luke was a beloved physician and had highfalutin terms, and Paul was a trained lawyer, and so his language is also challenging. Anyway, that about the book of Luke. I gave you an outline, and the first 3.5 chapters of Luke are introducing us to key players. The introduction of Jesus, but there are two supernatural births that we're concerned with. One, of course, was the birth of John, who comes first, and then the birth of Jesus, who comes later. John is born in chapter 1, and Jesus is born in chapter 2. And then in chapter 3, we have an extensive genealogy at the beginning of his ministry. And in chapter 4, his temptation. But tonight, we're going to look at the first 24 verses of chapter 1. That's our goal. I won't take you past 8 o'clock. But if we finish before, that I'll let you out early. Or you can ask questions. But look at the first four verses, Luke 1, 1 through 4. This is a power-packed group of verses. There's so much information that can be extracted from this. of great value. It says, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you might know the exact truth about the things you have been taught. Now, there's just a lot to unpack in that. Let's start with, many have undertaken to compile an account. What are your thoughts on that? Pardon?
Which was Mark. Mark was with Peter and questioned it and wrote down all the writings.
Okay.
Lots of questions.
How many? Look what Luke said. It seemed fitting, appropriate, maybe necessary. It was something that was appropriate and fitting to do. To do what? What did Luke do?
He gathered the account of the works of Jesus.
Investigated everything carefully. I wonder if there were any interviews of witnesses. Luke was not a Jew, was he? He was a Gentile. And I wonder if there were, like, interviews. So, in chapter 21 of Acts, Paul comes to Jerusalem bringing some gifts. And while he's there, he's ganged up on in the temple, arrested, and spends a couple years in jail in Jerusalem and Caesarea, and then is sent to Rome, where he spends another couple years in prison awaiting trial. What was Luke doing, for example, in that two-year period when Paul was in Jerusalem? We don't know, but my guess is he went around interviewing witnesses. He went talking to people who had seen Jesus, had been with Jesus, right? Now, it says, go ahead.
Various versions may have different words, but in the beginning of the Common English Version, verse 1, the phrase, many people have already applied themselves to the task, kind of strikes me in that I think I've unintentionally kind of limited that idea to other apostles.
Yeah,
not necessarily was just other apostles.
I suspect it's anybody who wanted to put down on paper, papyrus, for friends, family, or just for his own diary,
I guess it,
writing down what he understood to be true.
It strikes me that human nature probably hasn't changed much.
Yeah.
And whether it's the internet today, if we have an opinion, people seem to need to express it.
Well, I love Wikipedia.
The same was probably true then. The
yeah.
many, I expect, applies to more than just the apostles. And it almost has an air of, a lot of people have tried this. I saw fit to try and set it straight and make it right.
I think that's...
And here it is.
I think that's the point.
Yes.
There's a lot of, I won't call it misinformation, though it probably was misinformed, but it wasn't intentional misleading, though it might have been.
But it was an inferior source.
It was.
At least in Luke's opinion.
In Luke's opinion, it was an inferior source. It was an incomplete source, perhaps.
Yes.
This is what I heard. This is what I heard. Well, is it true or not? It's amazing how easy it is for a rumor to catch the root and foundation of believability. If it's said by enough people often enough, well, that must be the truth. And so that would be a real danger here of people thinking they knew and sharing what they thought was right. And so here Luke says, I investigated everything carefully. And for what purpose? Look at verse 4. Here's why I did it. Number one, I did it because there's just a lot of random reports out there. Number two, I did it so that you could know the exact truth, that you could know the exact truth of the things that you've been taught. So he'd been taught some stuff. I wonder if by that you might know the exact truth, if Paul is implying, or Luke is implying, that some of the people were accepting as true things that weren't. Because I want to believe things about Jesus. I hear stuff today. Somebody told me about this guy over here that heard something. And why do they do that? There's this desire to have it be true. So we've got, and we face that today. See? So we have this document, which was an investigative report about the life of Jesus. Okay? Now, look what it says. The things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us, by whom?
From those who were there from the beginning.
Those,
the apostles.
Yeah, who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. People who were with Jesus. Do you remember, of course, we're taking the books out of order. We had a wonderful study in the book of Acts about a year ago. Do you remember how many men were put forward to replace Judas? Do you remember?
Two.
Why only two?
Because they were the ones who were there from the beginning.
They had been with Jesus from the baptism of John until his ascension into heaven. They could be eyewitnesses of what Jesus did and said. Okay? And so that's who handed this down to us. It didn't come from Joe Blow over here who heard somebody say something about it. It came from the people who walked and talked with Jesus, who saw what he did, experienced it. So he says, I want to tell you about the things accomplished among us. Now that word accomplished there in verse 1, accomplished among us, gives you what idea? Remember what one of the seven sayings of Jesus on the cross? It is finished. It is finished implies we got it done. Things accomplished. There's a hint here at the reality, the hint at the reality that the life of Jesus was a life in which the prophets, the promises of God through the prophets were being fulfilled. And so accomplished, things that were accomplished among us. Now, what does he mean here from the beginning of what? Isn't that an important question, Susan? From the beginning, what beginning?
Jesus.
Not the beginning of time, but the beginning of this story, the beginning of God inserting Jesus into human history and what he accomplished through. So from the beginning were eyewitnesses. What's the value of eyewitness testimony?
No hearsay.
It's not hearsay. Okay? Eyewitnesses and servants of the word. It seemed fitting, appropriate. Oh, by the way, in verse 2, handed down to us by those, which means Luke wasn't one of those, right? Luke was one that had the advantage of and was blessed to hear what the eyewitnesses said, but he wasn't an eyewitness. He was one that got to mingle with the eyewitnesses and write down and record their testimony, but he wasn't one of them. All right? So he says, it seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully, from the beginning, to write it out for you in consecutive order. Now there's going to be stories here later in this chapter about angels appearing to Zacharias in the temple, about the promise of the birth of John, and about the birth of John and the people rejoicing over the birth of John. How did Luke know about that? There ain't but two ways that Luke would know about that. Pardon?
Probably talked to Mary.
Probably talked to Mary. May have talked to Elizabeth, if she was still alive, or their relatives. A lot of people experienced, as we'll see later today, experienced Zacharias coming out of the temple, mute, hand signaling. He had a vision. A lot of people experienced that. A lot of people were there when John was born, as we'll see in a couple weeks. Not next week, but the week after. So there were people that experienced. But I am an investigative reporter, Luke says, and I investigated everything carefully. He interviewed people. He took down their statements. Do you suppose it's possible to interview somebody who thought they saw something? And honestly, I did this one time. I heard an accident at the corner of my street. And I ran up and I saw what I thought happened. And when I said something about it, other witnesses said, that's exactly the opposite. And then I looked at the skid marks and I said, you know, what I thought I saw was wrong. And they're right. And I wonder if Luke ran into any of that, where people said something, but it wasn't validated by what the others said. Okay? So one way is to interview the witnesses and know their story. And of course, the other way would be if the Spirit of God guided him. And I think the Spirit of God did guide him in the selection of the stories that he heard and the weighing of the evidence. So I'm not saying that this book is merely the work of investigative reporting. I'm saying this book has the imprimatur of the Holy Spirit that used the information that Luke extracted. So I'm writing it out to you. Look at next in consecutive order. I'm going to tell you, I don't know if that means chronologically or not. It could be because there's some chronological between the various gospels. Let me ask you a question. Synoptic. Have you ever heard the term synoptic gospels? What does it mean? Syn means with, and optic means view. These three are taking the same view of the story of Jesus, and then there's John. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke are considered the synoptic gospel. But there's not discrepancies, but stories that are out of order. Scott, is it typically Jewish to run the story completely chronologically?
I was reading in 1 Kings 22, and they were talking about Ahab and Jehoshaphat, and they went all the way through Ahab and Jehoshaphat, and then they went right back to Jehoshaphat becoming the king.
Yeah,
in
the book of Kings especially, it's like a ratchet job. You follow this king till he dies, and he goes back and follows the other. But the book of Jeremiah, there's stuff all out of order chronologically. It's organized topically. Okay, so Luke, not being a Jew but a Gentile, so I'm going to write this out in consecutive order. Why did he do that? So that you might know the exact truth. So here we have this book. Now, by the way, Luke wrote Acts, the Gospel of Luke and Acts. Now, and we have then the story of Jesus from his preconception to his ascension in the book of Luke. We have the story of Jesus after his ascension through his apostles down to the end of Acts 28. Now here is, if there's something significant, this is it. Luke has demonstrated himself to be an historian of eminent quality. What is history? How do you know if a writing is history? There are four earmarks that mark the thing as historical. You know what they are?
Places,
Susan? Dates,
place?
People,
places, and events. Specific dates, specific places, specific people, specific actions or events. That's the substance of history. Now look at verse 5. In the days of Herod, there's time and a person. King of Judea, there's a place. There was a priest named Zacharias. So you have here, you go over to chapter 2, and in Luke 2 at verse 1. What does that say? It came about in those days that a decree, that's an event, went out from Caesar Augustus, that's a person, that a census should be taken of all the inhabited earth. This was the first census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. Do you see the earmarks, the stamp of history on that? Chapter 3, in verse 1. Now, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod was tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip was tetrarch of the region of Iturea and Trachonitis, and Licinius was tetrarch of Abilene, in the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John. That's history, folks. That's not once upon a time or in a galaxy far, far away. It's history. Real people, real places, real time, and real events. Now, Luke carefully investigated and wrote down the history in consecutive order so that we could know the exact truth. He did that with the book of Luke. He did it with the Gospel of the book of Acts. And so what we have is his historical matrix in Luke that all the other Gospels fit into. And we have this historical matrix in Acts that all of Paul's writings fit into. We have, in these first four verses of Luke, confidence to accept the New Testament, not just as the writings of men, but as the events of history, including the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, events of history, and all the implications that come from that. And I'll not pursue that any further. But like I said, the first four verses unpack pretty nicely in content. Do you have any questions or thoughts or comments at this point? Okay. I just want to say one more thing about what many have undertaken to do. There'll be two problems with what many have undertaken to do. Number one would be the misinformation, missing or wrong information. And wrong information or missing information, those are the two things. Wrong information or missing information. And so here Luke, going through the history, corrects that. What does it mean, most excellent Theophilus? Most excellent is a term of Roman dignity. And so, and Theophilus means, as we said, lover of God, friend of God. And whether that was this official's name or if that was his description, I choose to think that it was his description, because then it fits Susan as well. Theophilus, lover of God. See? All right. Now, in the days of Herod, verse 5, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zacharias of the division of Abijah. Let me finish reading this section. I'll come back and ask. Of the division of Abijah, and he had a wife from the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. They were both righteous in the sight of God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and requirements of the Lord. But they had no child, because Elizabeth was barren, and they both were advanced in years. So first of all, tell me four things that you learn about Zacharias and Elizabeth. Four things.
He was a priest?
He was a priest. He was of the division of Abijah. I'll talk about that in a minute. Susan?
She was the daughters of Aaron. Does that mean that her bloodline came all the way
through? Her lineage went all the way through Aaron. Now, here's something that is really important. The only priests, the only men that were allowed to be priests were direct descendants from Aaron. Not the entire tribe of Levi. Those were the Levites. But direct descendants from Aaron. Those were the only ones who were priests. And this woman was of that lineage. Okay? Obviously, so was Zacharias. Okay, what else can you tell me about?
They were old,
yeah. Well, that's the fourth thing. Advanced in years, old. What does that remind you of?
Sarah
and Abraham, right? They were old. Abraham was able to have kids, but Sarah hadn't had any. Okay. Two other things. What kind of people were they?
Jewish.
They were Jewish.
Righteous.
Blameless. Walking blamelessly. Good people. And
childless.
So they were priestly, righteous, childless, and old. Now, what is an Abijah? A division of Abijah. You know anything about that?
You got to go back
a long ways to find that in First Chronicles. Pardon?
The division of the priests.
Yeah, I had it written down, I left the right down at home. It's in First Chronicles 24. First Chronicles chapter 24. I'm going to turn over there and just give you a tad bit of insight, which is not common among us, because we're not of, I mean, that stuff was long ago and it's no longer functioning. And so it might be, what's in the division of Abijah? Abijah was a man, all right? Now, in 1 Chronicles 24:1, now the divisions of the descendants of Aaron, that's who we're talking about. Aaron's descendants were divided into 24 groups. 24 groups. And they were for the purpose of performing the temple service. And so you have, okay, Company B, you're up this week. Company C, you're up next week. You had 24 companies. And they would serve 1 week, and they'd do that twice a year. There's 24. Now, they didn't serve individually or separately, but when there was a feast, when I say individually or separately, at the feasts, all the divisions were involved. And so your divisions would exclude the weeks of the feasts. Anyway, if you look there, I think it's verse 10, says the seventh was for Hekaz, the eighth for Abijah. The eighth division was Abijah. Now, if it's starting at the first of the year, now the first of the year was probably correlates to our March, April would be the first of the year. And so this would be 8 weeks into that minus the whatever the feast days were, the festivals. And so this would put the division of Abijah functioning right around late May, early June, and then 6 months later, which would be late November, early December, the division of Abijah. Now, hold that thought, because that's the closest you're going to be able to come to dating the birth of Jesus. Okay? The story takes place in the division of Abijah, the service division of Abijah. All right, now, it happened, let's start reading again at verse 8. Now, it happened that while he was performing his priestly service before God in the order of his division, according to the custom of the priestly office, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. Imagine, all of the priests divided into 24 groups, and once every 6 months, Group 8 would go to Jerusalem and serve the temple, but there are far too many priests for them all to do the temple service. I mean, to do the offering of the incense in the temple itself. And so there would be seven separate occasions to do that. So there would be seven casting of the lots, and seven of the group that was there would be selected to go in and offer the incense. And it turned out that Zacharias was chosen. Okay, and so he went in to burn incense. Now watch verse 10. This is interesting. And the whole multitude of the people were in prayer outside at the hour of the incense burning. So here's this priest with all of his priestly regalia going in to offer the incense. Now the incense represented what?
Prayers.
It represented prayer. We learn that in the book of Revelation. It represented the sweet aroma of the prayers of the saints ascending to God. So he's in there offering the incense, and a multitude of people. Why is that important? The multitude of people.
Witnesses.
Witnesses. Whatever happened to him in there was whatever happened to him in there, and it was private. But when he came out, he had this whole body of witnesses that could testify to something spectacular happened, and we'll read on it and see what we could see. Okay? And so they're out there praying, and an angel of the Lord appeared to, by the way, Susan, how many access points did the temple have? If you were going to go into, have you got in your mind what the inner chambers of the temple look like? There was at the far west end a cube. It was 20 cubits by 20 cubits by 20 cubits. And it had a veil that kept everybody out except the high priest once a year. And then there was just to the east of that, still part of the same structure, there was a compartment that was 20 cubits by 40 cubits by 20 cubits. 20 wide, 40 long, 20 high. And that's where the altar of incense was. That's where Zacharias went in to burn the incense into the 20 by 40 compartment. It's called the holy place. The other one is called the most holy place. And there's only one way into the holy place. It was the veil at the east end. The only way in. So he gets in there, and all of a sudden there's somebody standing by him. Huh? Go ahead, Susan. Talk to me about that.
What would it have been a person? It had to be.
There would not be a Jew on the face of the earth who would be so irreverent as to go in there. And yet there's somebody there. Have you ever been in a place where you thought you're all by yourself and you hear a voice, and what does that do to you?
Startles you.
Yeah, yeah. And so he was startled. It says in verse 12, he was troubled when he saw him, and fear gripped him. What was he afraid of?
Well, that's really not normal.
It's totally not normal.
He's supposed to be the only one in there.
Yeah, and he knew he's the only one in there.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, there's this other guy in there, and fear gripped him. Yes, Michael.
So when one was in the presence of God for a long period of time, the radiance of the righteousness of God would illuminate them, just like Moses did with his presence upon the mountain. At least that's what my understanding would be for those that are the creatures that are before God.
Yeah, that's a speculation that we can't validate or verify. It's just somebody, let me say it this way. When Gabriel said, "I'm Gabriel," he says, "and you didn't believe me." So there was nothing about the personage that would say anything other than, "and there's a man in here with me." There wasn't any glow in the dark or extra radiant. That wasn't part of the story. And we shouldn't put that on there, especially judging by Zacharias' reaction to it. Okay, go ahead.
So, if Gabriel looked like a man, if there is a man in there, if Gabriel was a man, he probably wouldn't have been a good man.
Yeah, yeah. the righteous wouldn't go in there.
Right.
Okay? And so what are you doing in here? Are you here to steal the gold or take my life? So fear gripped him. And mainly, I would say, just generally categorize it, fear of the unknown. The startled fear of what I'm up against. I have no way to deal with that. And the angel said to him, do not be afraid. And then he says, your petition has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you will give him the name John. I love this. Don't be afraid. And then he says, your petition. What's a petition?
Request.
Yeah. A request. Go ahead.
Request his prayers. Yeah.
Yeah. What does that tell you?
They've been asking.
They've been. I like the way you said they. It didn't. You didn't say they asked. They've been asking. Mm-hmm. Okay. Scott, you were going to say something.
Just something about being afraid. I mean, there were Romans there, you know, and Romans had a tendency to kill people.
Yeah.
Without thinking.
And it could be that there was this interloper. It wouldn't be a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Go ahead.
Mary also was afraid when Gabriel. And
yeah.
It seems like when people are approached by an angel, it's a fearful thing. There's something about
some
them.
Dread that is associated. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know what. But anyway, don't be afraid. And that's exciting. You're afraid. Don't be afraid. Yeah. You know, I get that way with the animals I tend to. They're immediately afraid of me. And it's my job to calm them down and to ease their concern. And so the angel was doing that here for Zechariah. And your petition. I wonder how long they persevered in asking for a child. I think of Hannah, for example, how that she would ask regularly for a child, and she finally got Samuel. Your petition has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you'll give him the name John. Now, some commentators say, well, John is just kind of a contraction of Jonathan, and that's not correct. It's not Jonathan. It's Johannes. Johannes. Now, Yo is Yahweh. Yo for Yahweh. And Hannes is Hannah, like the wife that we were just talking about. Hannah prayed for and got Sam. You know what Hannah means? Grace.
Grace.
And so the idea of God is gracious. You name this boy, God is gracious. And I suggest to you, go ahead.
This struck me a moment ago that, you know, it says that your petition has been heard. But by now, my guess is they haven't been praying for a child recently at their age.
I don't know about that.
Maybe, but it's just a thought. I mean, I can't imagine, you know.
They were righteous.
Yeah.
They were righteous. They knew the story of Abraham and Sarah. They knew the story of Isaac and Rebecca, how that through prayer and intercession, God gave those women children. So, I don't know that I could join you in that assumption.
I'm just saying it's an interesting thought.
Yeah, yeah. Linda?
Well, it does say, Zechariah says, for I am an old man and my wife is advanced in years, kind of like. They've given up on it.
Yeah, it could be. how can I know that this is true? We'll get there in a minute. But that might well say... In verse 18, Zechariah said, how will I know this? Because I'm an old man and my wife is well advanced in years. So it could be that this, and Mary may well be right, that this was a petition that they had issued to God in their younger years, and here it is now finally being fulfilled.
But at the same time, prayer is not limited to things that are logically possible by our standards.
Are you sure? Yeah. And so we don't know enough to say, well, they gave up on this petition years ago or they had continued it. The point is that when they were both of childbearing years, they didn't have any children. But God listened to the petition. And so don't never give up on your prayer request. You probably have things that are heavy on your heart that you pray about. Don't ever give up on those. Because here he says, your petition has been heard, and your wife will bear a son, and you're going to call him God is full of grace. God is gracious. And what I find interesting about that is that John then is going to be introduced as the one who would introduce God's grace for all mankind through Jesus Christ. God is gracious. The forerunner bore. What does the name Jesus mean? Pardon?
God saves.
Yahweh saves, or Yahweh's salvation. Okay, so here's Yahweh's grace introducing Yahweh's salvation. That's kind of a cool thought, isn't it? All right, and then it says, you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth. Well, you get to the end of this chapter, and that's exactly what happened. But is that what he's talking about only? Look at the next verse. For he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He'll drink no wine or liquor. He'll be filled with the Holy Spirit while yet in his mother's womb, and he will turn many of the sons of Israel back to the Lord their God. It is he who will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers back to the children and the disobedient to the attitude of the righteous so as to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. So I think this phrase, you will have joy and gladness and many will rejoice, I think there's going to be the initial rejoicing, I got a baby. But I think there's going to be the ultimate rejoicing of what he accomplished as an adult. Okay? So, he will be filled with the Holy Spirit while yet in his mother's womb. The only comment I want to make about that is I gave a lot of thought to what he's trying to say here. And there are places in the writings of Paul that says, be filled with the Spirit. Don't be drunk with wine, but be filled with the Spirit. Filled with the Spirit, something that you could do for yourself, or at least present yourself as willing to accept. But then there's also, here's John, before he's even born, had no volition whatsoever. My thought is, there were two men that were in charge of the building of the tabernacle under Moses. Two men who would train all the craftsmen, and they were filled with the Spirit to accomplish this tabernacle building of God. And maybe that's the idea here. He's going to be so controlled by the Spirit that if he get the work done, I'm sending him to do it. In fact, he's going to start before he's born. Now, next week, we'll see when Mary comes to visit Elizabeth that John jumps for joy in the womb. So there's some activity. Anyway, that's really all I want to say about filled with the Spirit, unless you have a question. I do want to look at 16 and 17. He will turn, as soon as you read the word turn many of the sons of Israel back to the Lord their God. What's your impression?
Repentance.
Pardon?
Repentance.
Turn back. To whom do you say turn back? Someone that's in danger, someone who's off course, someone who is going down a path that will lead to danger or away from his destination. Turn back.
Rebellious.
Okay. Pardon?
Rebellious.
Could be rebellious. Right? Turn back. Any of these things shows mainly you're on the wrong path. What did Jesus say about himself in John? I am the
way.
I am the way. In the book of Isaiah, there was a way that leads to the new heavens and the new earth. And Jesus said, I'm that way. Turn back. You're on the wrong way. And, okay. He'll turn back the sons of Israel to the Lord their God. It is he who will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah. Pick up on that thought from my, 3 weeks ago? Malachi 4. That I'm going to send Elijah before the curse comes upon the land. Okay, I'll just go pick that up and Malachi 4, verses 3 through 6, 4 through 6. Malachi 4, 4 through 6. Malachi says, remember the law of Moses, my servant, the statutes, the ordinances which I command you, commanded him at Horeb. This is Malachi, the last word in the Old Testament. The God will go quiet toward his people until John comes on the scene 400 years later. And so he says, in that 400-year period of time, you have the obligation of remembering and keeping them. Behold, he says, I'm going to send you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. Now, without question and without variation, the great and terrible day of the Lord was a day of national judgment upon Israel. The prophets are replete using it that way. I'm going to bring a curse on the land. Watch what he says. And he will restore the hearts of the fathers to their children, the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the land with a curse. The great and terrible day of the Lord was when God cursed the land with a national invasion and destruction. But here, watch what he said. It was he who will go before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers back to the children, and the disobedient to the attitude of the righteous. That's Malachi. But not, or I'll curse the land. He says, I'm going to make a people ready or prepared for the Lord.
Malachi, these verses is also what Jesus refers to at the Transfiguration, correct?
Yeah.
In terms of, or after the Transfiguration.
And in Matthew 11, Jesus said, John is the Elijah who was to come.
And in 17.
Yeah. And here, this is the one that's going to go in the spirit and power of Elijah. That also makes us think of Isaiah 40, where a voice crying in the wilderness, make straight the way of the Lord. Here, what I'm trying to say is John, the angel is coming to Gabriel, or Gabriel is coming to Zechariah and saying, those promises that you and all Israel have been waiting for are in this boy of yours. Now that's got to be exciting. That's got to be exciting. And so Zechariah says, how can this be? How can I know? I'm an old man. My wife is advanced in age. So the angel answered and said to him, I'm Gabriel. Now, who's Gabriel? Kid down the street? Pardon?
He talked to Daniel.
He talked to Daniel. He's in the book of Daniel. You suppose Zacharias knew anything about Daniel?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was a righteous man, walking blameless before God. These things were important to him. He knew about Gabriel. I know about Gabriel. Okay? And so, I am Gabriel who stands in the presence of God. What does that mean? I stand in the presence of God. He was right there in the temple. I stand in the presence of God. It's not that I'm his right-hand man. But I'm standing there at his beck and call, ready to take a message out, deliver heaven's decrees. I'm Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God. And I've been sent to speak to you and bring you this good news. What about that? His good news? He says, how can this be? God offers you good news and you wonder how that can possibly happen. Isn't that so typically human?
Gideon did.
Pardon?
Gideon did.
Yeah.
Sarah did.
How can this be? And I think we underestimate the desire of God to bless his people. The desire God has to make our lives special. How can this be? I'm old. Or I underestimate the abilities of God. How can this be? I'm old. And the angel Gabriel said to him, I'm Gabriel, and I've stand here. And I bring you this good news, and behold, you're going to be silent and unable to speak until the day when these things take place, because you didn't believe my words. There was an expectation that when an angel talks to you, especially one that came right from God, and one that came to you in a place where you're not expecting anybody, in such a special place where you're offering up the prayers of incense, that you didn't believe me. And so you're going to be unable to speak until the child is born. which will be fulfilled in their proper time. Don't you love that? Just because I don't believe it doesn't mean it won't happen. You didn't believe it, it's going to happen. Just because you don't believe that I can and am able and I'm willing to bless you doesn't mean I won't bless you. But you're going to be mute until it happens. There's going to be a little bit. Is it a price he had to pay?
Well, it was an answer to his question.
How can I know? Yeah, it's an answer to his question. But it's more than an answer to his question. It's a sign to everybody that something special is taking place here. And we'll see that sense of something special just continue to arise here in this first chapter. Right? And so it says, it's going to take place. Verse 20 is where it says it's going to take place in the proper time. Verse 21, the people were, wait, now what people? The ones that were out there praying. This is probably a pretty typical thing. The priest goes in to offer, and so we're out here praying, you know, we're doing our due diligence to pray when the incense is going up. And they were wondering at his delay. What does that tell you?
It doesn't take long.
It doesn't take long, and they're accustomed to the priest going in, offering it, and coming right back out. But there's this conversation going on between Zacharias and Gabriel. And so the people, well, what's going on in there? Maybe he's an old man. Maybe he had a heart attack. You know, who knows what's going on in their heads? Big enough crowd, you're going to have all kinds of random thoughts taking place. And so they're out there wondering, and when he came out, he was unable to speak to them. I can't tell you what happened in there because I can't talk to you. But, you know, I can't call it American Sign Language because it's Hebrew. Was this HSL, Hebrew Sign Language, going on? He's gesturing somehow, you know, or angel. What's the code for angel in Hebrew Sign Language? You know, he's trying to convey the message, and so he's making signs to them and remain mute, and they understood. They realized he'd seen a vision in there. That's why it took so long. So he finished his priestly service, went back home, and after these days, Elizabeth, his wife, became pregnant. So at least he believed the angel a little bit. She became pregnant, and she kept herself in seclusion for 5 months. And there's a lot of speculation about why did she keep herself in seclusion. Was it bed rest? Was it embarrassment, awkwardness? I mean, I don't know how old, advanced in age is. Was she as old as Sarah, you know, pushing 90? A 90-year-old woman walking around pregnant? That's kind of an unusual thing that would make her a visual staring piece. So, I mean, you let your mind run. There's no way to know why she secluded herself for 5 months. And why 5 months? Why not six? You know, why? Anyway. And she was saying, this is the way the Lord has dealt with me in the days when he looked upon me to take away my disgrace from among men. Did Zacharias tell her what was going on, do you suppose? Now, we know that he couldn't talk, but we also know, as we read the rest of the story, that he could write. He wrote, his name is John. And as soon as he wrote his name as John, he started talking. So we know he could write. I wonder if in the next 9 months that they had any communication between each other. And the reason I'm asking all that is, look where her focus is. It's not on this child is going to be wonderful and bring in the Messiah. It's, I have my disgrace removed. And that was important to her. And I get that. She wasn't going to be able to be the mother of Messiah. Well, she probably would have known that anyway. Why do I say that? Why would she know, even as a young woman, that she couldn't be the mother of Messiah?
She wasn't from Aaron.
She wasn't from Judah. Okay? So, and I say that because that was a hope of all Jewish women, that they might be the mother of somebody special, at least have children, and lose the stigma of being the barren woman. And so she has that disgrace removed. Now in the sixth month, oh, by the way, I got to stop there because that's next week. I give you back 2 minutes. Any thoughts or comments?
Well, Elijah had a long time to think about all this.
Zacharias.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. He got the noodle on it for at least 9 months.
Yeah.
9 months and part of a week. Yeah, Glenn.
She brings up an interesting point. That is, they have been trying all these years to have a child. How many spontaneous abortions had she had? Maybe she was trying to wait the 5 months in order to be sure this one was going to stay.
Yeah, well, that's why I mentioned bed rest. It might have been just bed rest to preserve the pregnancy, but thank you for drawing that out. That's good. That you never know how many miscarriages she might have had along the way. That, now they finally have one. That's a good point. Other thoughts? Yeah? Go ahead, Scott.
Oh, just what the people were thinking when they saw this woman beyond childbirthing age pregnant.
Yeah, so she secluded herself for 5 months. It wasn't until a month later that Mary came, so she's out and around, right? Mm-hmm. She didn't wait for Mary before she got out and around. So she had 4 months to be walking around in public pregnant. And so.
Not natural.
It's not natural. Yeah, not natural. All right, we'll stop there. Appreciate everybody's participation. I hope that this is a taste of how exciting this class is going to be. Because it really is. It's just the historical Jesus coming to life in front of us. Okay. Well, Matt, would you lead us in a prayer as we close?
Sure.
By the way, everybody, the Matt that I'm talking about is my friend from Indiana, Matt Harrison. He's here on business and visiting us this week.